From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Peter Sagal. Being a well-known public radio host, people come up to me all the time, and they almost always say the same thing. They say, could you please stop making that noise while you're chewing gum? It's kind of gross. But not everyone says that. Some of them say, what's the coolest thing about being you? And I say, other than chewing gum loudly, it would have to be getting to meet really cool people, many of whom I've admired all my life, and then getting to ask them very silly questions. In fact, it happens every week in a game we call Not My Job. Well, this week we're taking some time off to review some of the more interesting interviews we've done recently. We're going to start with one of my favorites, Leonard Nimoy, also known as Mr. Spock from the original Star Trek. In September 2008, Mr. Nimoy joined us, along with panelists Charlie Pierce, Roxanne Roberts, and Paula Poundstone. I began the interview by letting my dork flag fly.
Thank you.
I want to jump right in with the most important question. In the episode of Muck Time, I'm not going to do that. No, I do want to.
That was one of our best, by the way.
Oh, I think so too.
Yeah, it really was.
Written by Theodore Sturgeon.
I'm so glad you mentioned it.
Yeah.
Spock was in heat.
He was.
Happens once every 7 years.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Well worth waiting for.
I know. It's interesting because, of course, an actor's question is, what's my motivation? But in that episode, boy.
Yeah.
Now, what I wanted to ask you about was, of course, the fame question. A short while after the series went off the air, you wrote a book, I Am Not Spock.
Yeah.
About 10 years after that, you wrote another book, I Am Spock.
That's also true, yeah.
So which is it? Which is it, Leonard Nimoy? Are you or are you not Spock?
Well, you know, it's a question of the duality of the actor's life. I was and I am and I used to be and I still am and sometimes I'm not.
You know? Yeah, I mean, it depends on the day, I guess.
Right, yeah.
Have you participated in the great, huge fan community? Have you gone to the conventions?
I have.
And how do you find that experience?
Well, it's heartwarming.
You see the Klingons at the elevators and take a right.
No, it's, the press, obviously, when the press comes to a convention, they immediately go to the people who are in costume and for the video. Yeah. But there are a lot of normal people.
Really?
Yeah.
They wandered in by mistake.
No, they're wonderful. No. Don't do that. Don't go there.
Look, I attended one once. And when I was a kid, a Mr. Spock jacket.
Were you in a Klingon outfit?
I had a Mr. Spock jacket. It looked like your tunic. It was blue, indicating
really?
A science officer.
Yeah.
It had the little Federation symbol. I was very proud.
That's great.
At one point, I was writing about Evander Holyfield when he was heavyweight champion of the world. And he was staying in a hotel for his training, and there was a Star Trek convention in the hotel, and the last thing I saw of Evander Holyfield, he was standing waiting in an elevator surrounded by Klingons. It's one of the most amazing things
he could take them out.
We appealed to a wide spectrum of an audience, and as a matter of fact, about a year and a half ago, I was at a political event, and one of our campaigners for the office of President of the United States saw me approach as he approached, and he gave me the Vulcan signal.
There you go.
Yeah.
Which,
it was not John McCain.
I was about to say. I was about to say.
Can I ask a non-greed question?
We'll be the judge of that.
The ears. Wait, it was about the ears, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So those were like foam, right?
Yeah.
Or something like that?
They were.
Do you have like a pair on like your mantle as like a keepsake?
Do you really?
I do.
You kept a pair of the Spock ears.
I have one pair. Yeah.
Wow.
I have the pair that was the that I wore on the very last day of filming of the original series.
Right. You took them home.
The real
That's
series.
That's great.
Real
series.
I'm very touched that you asked me that question. I am.
I can't believe this. You're not even a fan, and he likes you best. I'm so mad.
That's very nice. Thank you.
She doesn't even have the jammies.
I knew we shouldn't let any girls in here. I wanted to ask you about the movies.
You'll pardon me, but you are now the butt of the joke here.
Yeah, I know. So, I did want to ask you about the next Star Trek movie. You've been in a bunch of movies. You directed one or two of them? Two of them?
Two of them,
Two
yeah.
of them.
Yeah.
And the next one is directed, of course, by J.J. Abrams, progenitor of Lost and other TV shows. And this is going to be the one that shows the characters
of the original Star Trek series, Spock, McCoy, Kirk, of course, as young men and women coming out of the academy. So there will be, for the first time ever, another actor playing Spock.
At least one.
At least one other.
Yeah.
But you're in the movie, too.
Yes, I am.
How, sir, is that possible?
Through the magic of film.
I see. Are you telling me they have more than one pair of ears?
It's actually, I tell you, seriously, I really believe this is going to be a brilliant film. J.J. Abrams, who directed it, is a very, very talented guy. I think it's going to be a great film. It'll be out next June.
Right.
And it's called Star Trek.
Just Star Trek. Just.
I don't know if it has a subtitle, but right now it's just called Star Trek.
It could be like, for example, Star Trek, Those Guys Again.
Yeah, yeah, it could be, yeah.
Star Trek, Kirk When He Was Hot.
That's right.
For example.
Or When He Was Thin. Yeah.
One or the other.
Yeah.
Whoa! Hello. Yeah.
All right. I heard you guys had a little bit of a rivalry at the time. You and Bill Shatner?
No. We're very good friends.
You've done so much in your career. You've done photography. You've done poetry, music, acting. You've mind-melded with the silicon rock creature in the episode Devil in the Dark.
Good Lord.
One of our better episodes.
I thought so, too.
Yeah. Do you remember the moment? No.
No, come on, baby. Because I do. That's the thing. But my question for you is you're still so busy. Is there anything that you haven't done yet that you want to do or you want to do next?
No. I have no unfulfilled fantasy, no unfulfilled dreams. I left Boston when I was a kid. I was 18 years old. My dream was to make a living as an actor. And I've had great opportunities. And Star Trek particularly, there isn't a day goes by that people don't say to me, that show influenced my life. It affected my life in a positive way. So it's, you know, more than my dream has come true. I'm a very happy guy.
Ladies and gentlemen. Let me just qualify that statement. You're a happy guy up to this very point.
All right.
Because now...
All right. No. That's true.
We have invited you here to play a game that we're calling...
You're Not That Spock Either.
Oh. How weird was it that during the 1960s, two men named Spock would become world famous?
Yeah.
You were the cool, greenish, logical Spock. We thought we'd ask you about the area of expertise of the other Spock, Benjamin Spock. We're going to ask you three questions about the history of child rearing, taken from the book Raising America by Anne Hulbert. And if you get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their home answering machine. So, Carl, who is Leonard Nimoy playing for?
He's playing for James Gallagher of Plymouth, Michigan.
Oh, boy. Here, sir, is your first question. Dr. Luther Emmett Holt was the author of an 1894 child care book called The Care and Feeding of Children. He was optimistic in his book about very young children. He thought they could be trained to do what? A, speak a foreign language if you placed books in that language in their crib for them to play with. B, use a toilet correctly by the age of 3 months, but only if you, quote, start early. Or C, hunt, kill, and eat their own food if given freedom to pursue their natural instincts and a stick.
I would go for number two.
Very logical, sir. Yes, you were correct.
Yeah.
The good doctor said that toilet training is, quote, easily done by the third month if training is begun early.
How early?
I don't know.
Prenatally.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Prenatally, yeah.
That's very good. Here's your next question. The next great American child care expert was one Dr. John Broadus Watson. He was the author of Psychological Care of Infant and Child, published in the 20s. He lectured Americans for what he thought was a terrible habit. What? A, kissing, hugging, or otherwise being physically affectionate toward their children. B, feeding their children cow milk, which he was afraid would give them the physical attributes of cows. Or C, speaking to infants in baby talk, which he felt inhibited mental acuity and, quote, raised a nation of babblers.
Babblers?
Babblers.
Uh-huh. I'd go for that.
You'd go for that. He didn't want them to talk baby talk.
Yeah.
No, it was actually he didn't want them to kiss or hug their children. He said, Parents who kiss and hug their children, quote, are slowly building up a human being totally unable to cope with the world it must later live in, unquote. Instead, he suggested, at most, giving your child a firm handshake. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why your parents and grandparents were so screwed up. Here you go. Last question. Very exciting. This is, of course, about Dr. Spock himself. He became famous for his advocacy of a more permissive parenting style in the 60s. Once in an interview, he made a remarkable confession. What was it? A, when at home after work, he liked to spend hours playing with dolls. B, he couldn't abide rude children at all and always wanted to spank them. Or C, as a child, he himself was allowed to do whatever he wanted and he always hated his parents for that.
Wow. Logic doesn't even work here.
No.
Let's go for number one.
You're going to go for number one. Yeah. At home after work, he liked to spend hours playing with dolls.
Yeah.
It's incorrect. I'm so sorry. He couldn't rude children. He said to the Ladies Home Journal, quote, I can hardly bear to be around rude children. I have the impulse to spank them and to give a lecture to their parents.
Shame on him.
Isn't it awful?
Yeah.
Carl, how did Leonard Nimoy do in our quiz?
Well, Spock would have gotten all three right, Peter.
You know he would.
Leonard Nimoy.
I guess I'm not.
We figured it out. We've settled the question.
But Leonard Nimoy got just one correct answer, and he needed two to win for James Gallagher.
I'm so sorry. Leonard Nimoy is an actor, director, writer, and photographer. He's best known for playing the character Spock from Star Trek, the original series, and will appear in the upcoming Star Trek movie coming out next year. Leonard Nimoy, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Peter Sagal. This week, we are revisiting via the magic of tape recording some of our celebrity guest games. We have to do it via tape because I don't think they'd come back after what happened the first time. In September of 2008, Carl and I, along with panelists Mo Rocca, Kerry O'Connor, and Tom Baudet, ventured to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where we met one of South Dakota's finest native sons, former Senator George McGovern. McGovern was a hero in World War II. He's an upstanding and honorable patriot. But, of course, most people know him as one of the biggest losers in modern political history, the guy who got thrashed by Richard Nixon, 49 states to one, in 1972. Richard Nixon! Of course, McGovern had a handicap. He had to run as a Democrat.
Well, Democrats are an ornery bunch.
Yeah.
They're also people of conviction who love to express those convictions, even if it is 3 o'clock.
Right.
Yeah. In the morning. Yeah. So, and we didn't pay any attention to television schedules. I mean, what's prime time got to do with giving the most brilliant acceptance speech in American political history.
As you say, people of conviction. Where I'm from in Illinois, that has another meaning, but that's... President Nixon refused to debate you.
That's correct.
What reason did they give?
I think he was terrified.
What was the reason he gave?
He never gave a reason, and for some unexplained reason, the press never wrote him on that very hard. He used to talk about the bias of the liberal press.
No, really?
I never could find that liberal press.
Yeah, well.
But he never really gave an explanation for that. We never even had an explanation for things like... What were seven people, two of them carrying White House passes, doing with their burglar gloves, their break-in tools in the Democratic National Headquarters again at 2 o'clock in the morning?
I heard something about that.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting to me... people forget this. People think of Watergate and the scandal as happening post-election, but actually the break-in happened and was publicized... Before the election.
June 17th.
Yes.
A month later, we had the two conventions. It was still 3 months away from the national election, but no particular fanfare was raised about it.
Now, it is, of course, true that about 2 years after Nixon beat you in the 72 election, he had to resign in disgrace for the things that he had done during the election campaign. And to my knowledge, you never, indulged yourself by standing up in front of the American people and saying, I told you so. And I would like to invite you now, if you like, to do just that. Go ahead. Indulge yourself.
Okay.
Be venal. Be venal.
Okay. I've never said I told you so because I learned a long, long time ago, even before I got into politics, the one thing you don't want to say to somebody who already feels betrayed and injured is, I told you so.
Right.
That's not a good idea.
But aren't you the betrayed and injured party here?
The whole country was.
Well, yeah, I guess so. I know after your defeat in 72, you ran for president twice more, if I'm not mistaken.
Briefly.
Mm-hmm. You ever thought doing it one more time?
I think now I've had about enough experience to do it.
You think so? You think you're finally ready?
You know, maybe 4 to 8 years down the road, I'll try it again.
I think so. Senator McGovern, we are so pleased to have you with us. We've invited you here today to play a game we're calling...
Now that's how you win an election.
Senator, history shows that you were the better man in the 1972 presidential election, but a fat lot of good that did. Clearly, you lacked the killer instinct. So we're going to ask you three questions about some more hard-hitting political tactics as practiced in American elections. We're going to ask you three questions taken from the book Anything for a Vote by Joseph Cummins. Get two questions correct, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Carl, who is the senator playing for?
He is playing for Dave Munson from Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
All right, here's your first question. In 1824, Andrew Jackson was aiming for a rematch against John Quincy Adams, who had beaten him 4 years before. This time, Jackson was playing hardball. Among the successful attacks launched against the incumbent president were which of these? A, that President Adams smoked cigars in the European mode rather than chewing his tobacco like a true American? B, that President Adams had actually brought a billiard table into the White House for immoral purposes? Or C, that President Adams was secretly and shockingly a Reformed Baptist rather than the Methodist he claimed to be?
Probably the last one.
That he was a Reformed Baptist rather than a Methodist, which would have been all kinds of hoo-ha back then.
Yeah.
No, actually, it was the billiard table.
Was it the billiard table?
Yeah.
Us Methodists are against all of those things.
Really? Well, apparently. So are the American people. Jackson supporters called the billiard table, quote, gambling furniture. This worked, and Jackson won handily. All right, well, here's your next question. See what we do in this one. Sometimes slander doesn't work. For example, Martin Van Buren won the election in 1836, despite what bump on his road to the White House? Was it A, his opponent slandered him by calling him a, quote, Dutch American? B, he was arrested for riding his horse drunk through Washington? Or C, frontiersman and national hero Davy Crockett accused him of being a cross-dresser?
Maybe the first one?
The first one, they tried to slander him by referring to him as a Dutch American, mm-hmm. which would have been a term of disapprobation back in the day.
Yeah.
That's what you think?
I think so, yeah.
It was actually Davy Crockett. Called him a cross-dresser. Crockett, it turns out, I didn't know this myself, was sort of the swift boat veterans for truth of the day. He wrote a scandalous sort of basically hit book about Van Buren. In it, he wrote, and I quote, Martin Van Buren is laced up in corsets such as women in town wear, unquote. It went on in that vein. Mm-hmm. Fortunately for him, Crockett did not have to see the man he hated elected president because he was killed at the Alamo first. All right, here we go. This is your last question. See what you can do here. Now, the dirtiest election in American history, at least until yours, was between Samuel Tilden and Rutherford B. Hayes in 1876. There were widespread accusations of cheating, ballot stuffing, and, of course, there were smears on all sides. The Tilden people once accused Hayes of doing what? A, killing and eating a child. B, shooting his own mother. Or C, fathering 47 illegitimate children.
The third one sounds the most exciting.
Yo, yeah. You say that, I begin to think maybe Spiro Agnew was right about you. I don't know. But your choice is fathering 47 illegitimate children, which does, now that you mention it, sound like fun. No, the answer was B, shooting his own mother. The slander was spread in anonymous letters sent to Ohio newspapers. It was a swing state back then, too. So, Carl, how did Senator McGovern do in our quiz?
Peter, the senator continues to lose big.
But with honor.
Yes.
But with honor. Well, like I mean, you know, you're a man who rises above the contest he's forced to engage in. So I appreciate it. We appreciate you for doing it here. George McGovern is, of course, a former World War II decorated bomber pilot. He was a member of the U.S. House of Representatives and served with distinction in the United States Senate. He was the Democratic presidential nominee in 1972. He now works to fight child hunger around the globe. George McGovern, thank you so much for joining us. An honor to have you with us. Senator McGovern. In October of 2008, along with panelists Roy Blunt Jr., Tom Baudet, and Allison Stewart, we were joined by another son of the plains and one of the giants of public radio, Garrison Keillor, creator and host of A Prairie Home Companion. It turns out he doesn't really like being called one of the giants of public radio.
I am not responsible for public radio, Peter.
You're not?
I refuse to accept responsibility.
But it's a pretty good thing.
You people are on your own.
But isn't it true? Let me argue the point. You started the show 35 years ago. Public radio was a pretty minor thing, but you became one of the first real stars. People started turning to public radio to hear your show, and they discovered all those other wonderful things that are now on it.
I don't recognize anything that you're saying. Accomplished. Accomplished. That, you apply that to pianists.
Well, let me congratulate you anyway. 35 years of Prairie Home Companion is quite remarkable.
It's just it happens when you have very poor job skills. You might get stuck in the same sort of trench.
You think so?
Yes.
So it was really a failure of you to learn to do anything else. Is what
I wasn't
you're
qualified for anything.
I understand.
As you get older, is it harder and harder to get funny? Be funny.
Could you ask me that question again?
That was Roy. Roy, go ahead.
Could you ask that question louder, please?
Have you gotten older enough that it's harder to be funny now, Gramps?
Getting older is a cinch. You just wait around. You just hang out.
Okay.
I have been lucky enough to see you do your show live. It is a remarkable thing. And, of course, to see you do the news from Lake Wobegon, which most people don't know this, that you do not do that from, at least as far as I can see, any prepared notes or paper. You just wing it out there.
The text is projected onto the floorboards.
Oh, how excellent.
And onto the tips of my shoes. So
yes.
As long as I don't make eye contact with the audience, I'm fine.
I was going to ask you, because I know that you've been doing this for so long, but you do many other things. You've written many, many books, including your latest book, Liberty, a novel of Lake Wobegon. And as is, you're a columnist. One of my favorite things that you ever did, actually, was when you wrote an advice column for Salon.com, Ask Mr. Blue. And I just loved that. You were really good at that.
I advised young people such as yourself, Peter, not
yes.
to get stuck, but to be free and to be adventurous. I recommended adventure. I recommended picking up and pulling out. I was a reckless advice columnist.
Really?
Yep.
You were just sending people to basically light out for the territories. That was your...
I advised them that, and then my daughter got to the age when I didn't want her to be reading that sort of advice.
I see. You thought maybe she should not light out for the territories.
No, I thought that she should go to the visitation convent and stay there until the mood passed.
Well, Garrison Keillor, we're so honored to have you with us. We have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Where the men are unemployed, the women are bored, and the children tend to be obese.
Now... Since you are an acknowledged authority on the stalwart, hardworking people of the northern climes, we thought we'd take you all the way around the world to Nauru, a tropical Pacific island. We'll ask you three questions about the island of Nauru. It was inspired by a profile of the island on This American Life. If you get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice, on their home answering machine. So, Carl, who is Garrison Keillor playing for?
Peter, Garrison is playing for Jackson Cooper of Wake Forest, North Carolina.
Are you ready to play, Garrison?
As ready as I'll ever be.
Well, then let's do it now before you become less ready. Nauru is a superlative little island. It is the smallest independent nation in the world, and during the 1970s, it had what other distinction? Was that A, it had the world's highest per capita income, B, it boasted what a travel magazine called, quote, the world's most repulsive beach, or C, it was the only place in the world to find the world's most poisonous frog?
In multiple choice tests I took in college, mm-hmm. C was correct about two-thirds of the time.
I just want to point out that I also took those tests and learned that lesson.
I'm guessing C,
the poisonous frog. No, actually, it was A, the highest per capita income.
You know, that was going to be my second choice.
I'm sure it was. The island is more or less made of phosphate, a very valuable mineral, or I should say it was made of phosphate. The islanders got extremely rich basically selling off their island. And now that it's all gone, they live poor and unemployed on a narrow coastal ring around a rocky wasteland. Next question. Now, having run out of phosphate, the islanders have tried to come up with new money-making schemes, including which of these? A, offering their island to movie companies as a stand-in for a hostile alien planet. B, investing in a big Broadway musical. Or C, offering the presidency of their country to anyone willing to pay $40 million for it.
I've so often found that C is the correct answer. Multiple choice test.
Yes. You think so, but you don't think that I would anticipate a mind such as yours working in that sophisticated way and take counteractive measures.
Yeah, I think they've offered the presidency to somebody willing to pay $40 million.
Because wouldn't it be fun to be the president of your own little tropical island, denuded as it might be?
Of course, my second choice would have been A.
I haven't called it yet, so you get to actually vary your choice if you choose.
I'm going to switch to A.
I'm going to switch to A.
I heard something in your voice.
So the movie company is the hostile alien planet.
Yes.
It was B. An Australian financial advisor convinced them to invest $2 million in a musical biography of Leonardo da Vinci that flopped. So that did not work out for them.
I have never trusted this American life.
Really? There's just something so hip about them. It makes me uncomfortable.
And now I trust them even less.
I think you were wise to do so. Sadly, that remains true. You have one more question. Let's see what we do here. Optimism. Optimism.
B.
C. Just go for C.
Okay.
All right. Last question. Nauru, like a lot of Pacific islands, has a problem with obesity. It's made worse on Nauru by almost 90% unemployment. To deal with the epidemic, the government did what? A, held the first ever Nauru half marathon, one lap around the island, with five entrants and no finishers. B, they started a just one can of spam tonight public awareness campaign. Or C, they held a big is beautiful beauty pageant.
I've so often felt that C
yes.
is the answer on these tests.
C? You're going to go for C?
I think that they held a beauty contest.
And you were right. They did.
All right.
They did. Beautiful. Beauty contest. To his credit, the president of Nauru did try to inspire the people of his island to exercise. He took a walk in public along the island's one airport runway, a whole kilometer. Mm-hmm. He was then airlifted off the island for emergency medical treatment soon thereafter. Carl, how did Garrison Keillor do in our quiz?
Garrison had one correct answer, Peter, but he needed two to win for Jackson Cooper.
Oh, well. Garrison Keillor is an author, storyteller, columnist, musician, and perhaps most famously the host of A Prairie Home Companion on public radio stations nationwide. His latest book is called Liberty, A Novel of Lake Wobegon. Garrison Keillor, thank you so much for joining us today.
From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Peter Sagal. This week, a review of some of the more memorable celebrity interviews we've done in the segment we call Not My Job. They say that traumas make for the most vivid memories, which is why we remember a particular day in early September 2008. We did our show outdoors at Millennium Park in downtown Chicago. It's a magnificent architectural masterpiece, but it has one tiny flaw. It does not have a roof, which is a problem on the day of the biggest rainstorm of the year. Fortunately, Our guest that wet day was a true gamer, Moose Skowron, an all-star veteran of the great Yankees dynasty of the 1950s and early 60s. As panelists Tom Baudet, Paula Poundstone, and Morocco found out, he is a little touchy about his stats, though. 5 World Series victories in total. You played in 6 World Series?
I played in 8 World Series.
Played in 8?
8, we won 5.
Right.
Four with the Yankees, 1 with the Dodgers, right. 1963.
Right, and you played with the Yankees in the 1950s with that, what they call the second golden era of the Yankees, with Mantle and Joe DiMaggio.
I never played with DiMaggio.
You never played with Joe DiMaggio? No, he retired before you.
He retired in 51, and I got there in 1954. I was with the Yankees 9 years. We won 7 pennants.
Wow.
Got to remember, good trivia, the 3 M's, Maris, Mantle, and Moose. We might have had a few cocktails, but we're not no steroids.
Really?
That's for darn sure.
As they say, you did it on beer.
I said, some of us.
Yeah.
Some of us. I wish to hell I was playing 1 year. I'd be a multimillionaire today.
Yeah.
I made $500,000 in 17 years, and I was in 8 World Series. The winning share in the World Series in the 50s was $8,000, and the loser share was $5,000. Today it's $400,000 for winning and $200,000 for losing.
Yeah. It's like you were playing baseball for NPR.
Now, and you were telling me earlier, you were saying that you guys back in the day were a little tougher than the players today.
Oh, well, if you hit a home run today, like Soriano, and he's watching the ball go over the fence, in our time, if Drysdale or Bob Gibson would be pitching, Soriano would be in the hospital. They wouldn't take that stuff. I mean, Mickey Mantle used to let a lot of long home runs, but when he ran around the bases, he always had his head down. But today it's so different. And now you can't pitch inside to anybody. You might hurt them. I got hit in the head one day. Ike Delock from the Boston Red Sox. I hit a home run off of him, and Ted Williams told me the story. He says, when Ike Delock come back to the bench, he says, the next time Moose comes up, I'm going to hit him right between the eyes. Well, he hit me right in the head. I go to first base. Casey Stengel says, Moose, can you read the scoreboard? I read the scoreboard. I says, God, let my roommate Bob serve hit a ground ball to the shortstop. Hand it to second base. I'll go break up that double play. Who was playing second base? A guy by the name of Gene Mock. I broke his leg. And he never played another game in the major leagues. I didn't do it on purpose. I just happened to. We were taught to break up double plays. Now these guys are afraid to slide because their agent says, don't get hurt. And that's the way it was in the old days. Not like it is today.
Wow, no.
Wow.
I got to ask you one last thing before we play the game. One of the great things players of your era had, of course, was the nicknames. Pee-wee, Dizzy, yours was Moose. Where did it come from?
Well, Grandpa, when I was 7 years old, my grandfather shaved off all my hair. And I got outside, and all the older guys started calling me Mussolini. At that time, he was the dictator of Italy. And as years went on, my first name in Polish is Bolesław Józef Skowron. It means William Joseph Skowron. That's why I got my nickname. And Mickey and Whitey used to always say Bill to me, and I wouldn't answer them back. If they call me Moose, I talk to them. Other than that, they like to agitate me, which is fine. I didn't care.
No, you've forgotten all about it.
Well, Moose, we are so delighted to have you with us here. We have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
You're bad, you're dangerous, you're invincible. And now you're eligible to join the AARP.
As hard as it is to believe, entertainer Michael Jackson turned 50 last week.
Oh, my heavens.
He celebrated, he says, with a quiet party at home, watching cartoons with his kids. And it is a tribute to his remarkable history and place in our culture that, in this case, watching cartoons with the kids sounds really creepy. Nonetheless, we're going to ask you, Moose, 3 questions about the king of pop. Get 2 right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carol Castle, singing The Man in the Mirror on their home answering device.
Wow.
Carl, who is Moose Skowron playing for?
Peter, he is playing for Quinetta Daniels of Chicago.
Here we go. First question. Everyone knows that for a while, Mr. Jackson's best friend
was a pet chimpanzee he called Bubbles, but he didn't want Bubbles merely for companionship. He said the chimp also worked for his monkey chow. How did he do that? A, Bubbles had an excellent ear. If Bubbles screeched along to a new song, Jackson could be sure it would be a hit. Was it B, Bubbles, a neat and tidy chimp, routinely cleaned Mr. Jackson's bedroom? Or C, Bubbles, using crayons and finger paint, created artworks which fetched thousands of dollars in auction?
A or B, you want me to say A,
I want
B
you to say A, B, or C? He was either, he listened to the music and told him whether it was good or bad.
I'll say A.
You're going to say he listened to the music. If Bubbles screeched in a chimpanzee fashion, Mr. Jackson would know that the song was a good one, if Bubbles right. liked it. That's a great idea, but no, it was actually B. He cleaned Mr. Jackson's bedroom. So according to Mr. Jackson, Michael Jackson said this in some unaired footage in that famous BBC documentary. He said Bubbles would dust the bedroom. All right, you still have two more chances.
Okay.
Yeah, just strike one. But now, you know, that's nothing. That's nothing. You still have two more strikes. Here we go. During the early 1990s, crew members who worked on his various films, videos, and other projects had to sign a contract in which they had to agree to do what? A, to refer to Mr. Jackson at all times in the third person, as in, would Mr. Jackson like his lunch now? B, not ever, ever to stare at him. Or C, to only listen to Michael Jackson's music on their Walkman CD players or stereos during the shoot.
I'll say A.
You're going to say A, that they had to refer to, if somebody came up to Michael Jackson, instead of saying, would you, sir, that I'd say, would Mr. Jackson? No, actually, it was B. They were not allowed to stare at him.
It was so close.
I know. Last question.
Oh, God.
Here we go. Even though he's 50 years old now, Michael Jackson is not slowing down. According to a British tabloid, what is the King of Pop up to these days? A, he's writing an autobiographical opera in which he will play himself at all stages of his life. B, he's creating a line of frozen foods called Come Eat with Michael. Or C, he's dating bodacious actress Pamela Anderson.
I say C.
You're going to go for Pamela Anderson.
Yeah.
You're right. He's dating Pamela Anderson.
Thank God.
Apparently. Thank God. According to the Daily Mirror tabloid, Michael Jackson has had two private meetings in Malibu with a 41-year-old former Baywatch star, once for drinks, once for coffee. I presume they discussed things of mutual interest like being a divorced parent, the trappings of fame, plastic surgery. Carl, how did Moose Garman do in our show?
Peter, he had one correct answer, but Moose needed two to win for Granetta Daniels.
Mm. But he does win the consolation prize, which is Pamela Anderson.
Exactly true. Moose Garman is a six-time All-Star first baseman.
Eight-time All-Star. Eight World Series and eight All-Stars.
Eight World Series, eight All-Stars. A Chicago baseball legend, Moose Garman, so delighted to have you with us. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for the Moose. Bravo.
In March of 2008, Carl and I went with panelists Roy Blunt Jr., Charlie Pierce, and Paula Poundstone down to Birmingham, Alabama, and we were honored to meet there Jimmy Carter, the leader of the legendary gospel group, the Blind Boys of Alabama. He told us the story of how his group got their starkly descriptive name.
Well, the Blind Boys of Alabama met at the Talladega Institute for Deaf and Blind. This school was funded by the state of Alabama, and all of the blind children that wanted to get an education came to that school. So that's how we met. We started singing together in 1939. We started out as the Happyland Jubilee Singers. The Blind Boys, that name came years later. That's another story entirely.
Well, how did that happen?
I don't have time to tell it.
Oh, we got all the time you need.
Well, that was another group of blind people called the Jackson Harmoniers out of Jackson, Mississippi. And they started out about the same time the Blind Boys of Alabama did. And this guy, this promoter of gospel music in Newark, New Jersey, thought up this gimmick. He said, I'm going to bring the Blind Boys of Alabama and the Blind Boys of Mississippi to Newark, New Jersey, in a battle of music. That's how the Blind Boys got their name.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy Newark? Because I'm thinking that you'd have to be blind to do so. And I'm from New Jersey. I get to say that.
Yeah, okay. Well, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, you've been singing gospel music then for, 54, 55 years on the road professionally.
Maybe.
Yeah? Were you ever tempted in all those years to dip into other forms of music, to try your hands?
No.
So many came and went while you were doing it.
Yeah, well, you know, Sam Cooke did. And we were all the same. The same time he got his offer, the line board had the offer too, but we turned it down.
Really?
The same day.
The same day?
The same day.
And you turned it down?
Turned it down.
Why?
We wanted to sing gospel music. We were a dedicated gospel group, and we promised the Lord that we would never deviate from that. So we are still here. And we're going to stay here till he says that's enough.
We understand, we are told that you have that one of your roles with the group is and has always been, you're the guy who likes to go out in the audience and get everybody excited. Is that true?
That's correct.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You still do that?
Still do it.
Yeah. How do you do that? You just walk out there and...
Well, no, I have a guy that takes me out.
And what do you do when you get out there into the big halls?
I just get out there and just do my thing.
Jimmy, have you ever had kind of a dead crowd that didn't respond even when you're trying to get them going?
Well, you know, when I walk out, I tell them this. I say, now, the blind boys do not like a conservative crowd.
You like them to give it up.
Mm-hmm. We like a noisy crowd.
Yeah. 99 won't do.
99 won't do. Got to be 100.
There you go.
Let me ask you this. You've been, one of the things that's happened last decade or so, maybe even longer, you guys have really been embraced by mainstream music. You've sung with a lot of musicians, have invited you to sing with them on their records and concerts. You've been put in movies on the Broadway stage. How's that been for you? Because you've labored for so long in the gospel world, now you're...
Well, you know, I always say, this is my philosophy, better late than never.
There you go. I just got to ask you one last question. We've been doing this with all the musicians that have been coming in the show in the last year or so. And this is interesting because this is the first time we've put it to a pure singer. What do you think, Jimmy Carter, is the sexiest musical instrument? So, for example, we asked that to Branford Marsalis. He thought it was the saxophone. Weird Al Yankovic thought it was the accordion. Surprise. So, you who don't play an instrument per se other than your own voice, what do you think is the sexiest instrument?
My voice.
There you go.
I think we've got a band now.
I think so. I think so.
Put all those guys together.
Well, Jimmy Carter, we are so thrilled to have you with us here. We have asked you here to play a game with us, and we are calling it
You Don't Even Like Peanuts.
We're guessing that you have spent a fair bit of time since the 1970s either apologizing to audiences or reassuring them, more likely, that they weren't about to be serenaded by the 39th President of the United States. So we're going to see how much you know, sir, about the other Jimmy Carter. Get two out of these three questions right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice, on their home answering machine. Carl, who is the more fun Jimmy Carter playing for?
Well, Jimmy is playing for Barry Nichols of Anniston, Alabama.
All right, Jimmy, here we go. Jimmy Carter entered the race as only a one-term ex-governor of Georgia. What did his mother, known as Miss Lillian, say when he told her he was running for president? Did she say, A, quote, that's nice, son, and I'll be your empress? Did she say, B, quote, did Billy put you up to this? Or did she say, quote, president of what?
I'm going to take C.
You're going to take C. President of what?
Yeah.
Very good, sir. Yes. Very good. Now, Jimmy Carter gets criticized a lot for his various failures as president, stagflation, the Iran hostage crisis. But he did accomplish at least one inarguably good thing. What was it? Was it A, he made home brewing of beer legal throughout the land? B, he allowed children in the White House lawn Easter egg roll to use spoons rather than their noses? or C, via an executive order, he finally allowed cabinet members to remove their ties at work?
Okay, I'm going to say B.
You're going to say B. He allowed children in the White House long Easter egg roll to use spoons rather than their noses. That's your choice?
That's my choice.
I'm afraid not now. It was actually home brewing.
Really?
Home brewing. In 1979, President Jimmy Carter signed a law easing federal restrictions on brewing your own beer. However, some states kept their own restrictions on it, including, I am very sorry to say, Alabama.
Oh.
Well, this is very exciting, Jimmy, because if you get this last question right, you'll win it all. So you have one right with one to go. Here we go.
Yeah.
Here's your last question. Carter famously tried to make the White House seem more relaxed than it had been under his predecessor, Richard Nixon. In fact, the White House got so relaxed, what once happened? Was it A, presidential guest Willie Nelson went up to the roof of the White House and smoked a joint? B, President Carter once received his daily intelligence briefing in the Oval Office while wearing his bathrobe and Mr. Peanut slippers? Mm-hmm. Or C, the red hotline phone from the Soviet Union went unanswered for 4 minutes because the president and his aides were playing trash can basketball.
I'm going to say B again.
You're going to go for B. President Carter once received his intelligence briefing in the Oval Office wearing a bathrobe and Mr. Peanut slippers.
Silly, yeah.
It was A. It was Willie Nelson.
Oh.
Willie Nelson. He played a concert at the White House. And then he says he went up to the roof to smoke a, quote, Austin blunt.
Well, I know he's capable of it.
Yeah, I was about to say. I'm surprised, because I bet you've met Willie Nelson in your travels, have you not?
Yeah, I have.
And you'd probably...
I didn't smoke nothing with him, though.
No. I'm just saying you would. Carl, how did our Jimmy Carter do talking about the other one?
Well, Jimmy needed at least two correct answers to win for Barry Nichols, but this Jimmy had just one correct answer.
Sorry, Barry.
Well, you know.
Maybe next time.
Yeah, I think so. Jimmy Carter is one of the founding members of the Blind Boys of Alabama gospel group. They're on tour across the country in support of their new album, Down in New Orleans. For more information, you can go to blindboys.com. Jimmy Carter, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, sir.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio. In association with Urgent Haircut Productions, Doug Berman, executive producer. B.J. Lederman composed our theme, technical direction by Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. Our program is produced by Emily Ecton. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Thanks to all our guests, all our panelists, to Carl Castle, and of course to all of you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal, and we'll be back next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.